This episode is brought to you by Snapple. Want to know another Snapple fact? The first hot air balloon passengers were a sheep, a duck, and a rooster. Ridiculous. Check out Snapple.com to find ridiculously flavored Snapple near you.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of four episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture Gabfest. Marconi Plays the Mamba Edition. It's Wednesday, September 7th, 2016. On today's show, I Love Dick is the new Amazon pilot by Jill Soloway, creator of Transparent. It stars Griffin Dunne and Catherine Hahn as passive-aggressive bickerers trapped in a hellish marriage, and Kevin Bacon as a charismatic intellectual who changes both of their lives. Presumably, we'll find out if it gets picked up. And then what does it mean to be, almost without controversy, the worst song of all time? GQ has given us an oral history of We Built This City by Starship. Along the way, we'll discuss the very concept itself, while no doubt offering our very own contestants for the crown of scorn. And finally, Hollywood has had a bad summer. Is it fair to say, finally, that movies, as we've known them at least for 100 years, are dying or changing into something unfamiliar? We'll discuss. Joining me today is Slate's editor, Julia Turner. Hello, Julia.
Hi, Steve.
And of course, Dana Stevens, Slate's film critic. Hey, Dana.
Hey, Steven.
Julia, I sort of think of this as the beginning of the year.
You know? I was going to say Happy New Year to you.
I know. It feels like that.
I feel like such a...
Happy Q1?
No, it's Q... Well, depends which... The Slate fiscal calendar means this is Q3 heading into Q4.
Oh, that's so festive. The French actually
fireworks.
Do have an expression for this time of year. They say bonne rentrée, good return. Because, of course, they've all had just had 6 weeks of holidays on the beach.
God,
and they're going
them.
Back to school with their little French school bags.
Yeah, it does always feel like the start of the new year. I feel like that's appropriate to us as an academic show. I definitely feel like when I married into Judaism, I was like, yes, this is right. This is correct. The new year should be now.
Mm-hmm. Surely this means we have some business we need to attend to before digging in.
Yes, I have two pieces of business this week. First of all, we are doing a live show in Los Angeles with the lovely Karina Longworth, star podcastress extraordinaire, on Thursday, October 13th. You can get tickets for that show at slate.com/live. It will be at the lovely Aero Theater in Santa Monica on the west side of Los Angeles for all you lazy boneses who thought it was too onerous to drive to the east side last time we were in town to come see us. There are still some tickets left, so snatch the last few up at slate.com/live. Second, this is the final week that our beloved producer Anne Happerman is producing us. And so we have invited her on to be our guest for Slot Plus. She has another audio love. That love is audio fiction. She is the doyenne behind the Sara Awards and the Serendipity podcast, which are must listens if you are an audio fiction buff. And if you are not an audio fiction buff yet, what are you waiting for? It's 2016. Get with it, people. So we will hear from the mastermind of these efforts and hear a few great clips of the work that Anne is championing in our Plus segment. So join us there. And if you're not yet a member, join at slate.com/cultureplus to hear segments like that and to support Slate and the work that we do. All right, Steve, I think we are ready to commence.
Indeed we are. Okay, digging in. I Love Dick is based on a cult novel of the same name about a relationship between an aspiring filmmaker, a married woman, and a cultural critic, the eponymous Dick, with her older and somewhat unique husband acting as a cuckold or possibly a pander. I guess we find out as it goes. A pomo love trio unfolds against the backdrop of Marfa, Texas, and the haute creative class, the artists, writers, the sudes and blowhards that gather there. The book it's based on was metafictional and sprawling. Jill Soloway has promised not to simplify it for the small screen. She's awaiting, I suppose, a green light from Amazon to continue making it. We watched the pilot. Let's listen to a clip.
Yeah, and before the clip starts, we should note that the whole show is kind of cut through with these title cards that are intended to be excerpts from letters that Chris Krauss, the main character, writes to Dick, the Kevin Bacon character. So you'll hear one of those at the top.
Dear Dick, this is about obsession. How did we not know each other before now? This is about me missing you, even though I've never met you, Dick.
Hi, I'm Chris Krauss.
Well, hello, Chris Krauss.
Dick, right?
That's me.
Love that you just go by Dick, because usually someone would, you know, if one is born a Richard, they would Rich, Rick, Richie, Ricky. So many.
Just Dick.
Is it possible that I saw you on a horse yesterday?
Yeah, I have a ranch just outside of town.
Oh. How big? Curious.
You want to know how big my ranch is? No more polite to ask a rancher the size of his acreage than to ask a lady her age.
I'm straddling 40-ish.
Straddling?
I had forgotten quite how filthy that clip was, and I also love the, like, noise-canceling headphone, like, thwom effect in the background. Like, the party noise drops out as she sees him, and they have this charged exchange, and then it comes back there at the end.
All right. Well, Julia, why don't I start with you? Let's begin by offering maybe a little bit of a caveat.
Wait, did you give that the Latin pronunciation?
I did.
I was politely ignoring that humiliating moment for Steve. Cave canem. If you will.
Kawe podcast host.
Oh, dear. Get me a one-way ticket to Marfa, Texas. Jesus. Anyway, let's offer a brief caveat here, which is that we, years ago, watched the first episode of Transparent when it was also an Amazon pilot and when its fate was also up in the air. And I think we had kind of ambivalent feelings about it. I personally went on to really almost venerate the show. I think it's a work of genius. Or near genius or whatever. You can't tell anything about a pilot. You especially can't tell anything about a pilot that's, you know, essentially a flyer on a show that may or may not go. Nonetheless, we watched it. We had feelings about it. What were yours?
Well, I mean, you know, the whole TV business is in the business of judging things based
on
pilots.
I'm just trying to keep us from looking like total dipshits a second.
But we liked Transparent, didn't we?
Yeah, we did. We just talked about it before. It was a massive cultural phenomenon, and we never went back. We probably should at some point. It could be an esprit d'escalier, Slate Plus. This show, however, I mean, as Willa Paskin pointed out in her review for Slate.com, Jill Soloway is the main creative force at Amazon, right? She has their most talked about, most buzzed about, most widely venerated show on the air in Transparent. So they're going to let her do her next thing. It behooves them to do so, whether or not it's good. And here it is. And I did not find this show to be super compelling. And I'm perhaps hamstrung by not having read the book or having a hint of the what sounds like a pretty compelling and strange and distinctive and particular story that it comes out of, like having a sense of how that might unfold or where it might go. But the like sexual woes of the upper artsy middle class seemed, I don't know, like it just seemed a little hermetic. And then the choice to put it in Marfa, which is its own, I mean, it's certainly picturesque and fun and kind of this like great mix of forces. It sounds like it adds visual interest to the show, but it just makes the whole thing seem like such a little hothouse flower that it doesn't feel particularly urgent.
And the book is not set in Marfa, correct?
No.
That was Soloway's choice for the show.
Yeah. Which yeah. I can understand. I mean, the one time I went to Marfa, it seemed like everything should be set there forever. It's a crazy place, but it's so singular and specific. It feels like the foibles of people toiling there seem random.
Yeah, you know, I was so excited for us to talk about this show, both because of the Soloway factor and because it stars Catherine Hahn, who I feel like has been sort of the great sidekick in comedy after comedy after comedy in the last few years and never gets a title role. And so the best thing about it to me is that you get a chance to see Catherine Hahn doing her thing. And even though this show is not funny, I don't even think it's meant to be sort of knee-slappingly funny, although it is a half-hour, vaguely comedic format. But Catherine Hahn is just interesting. She has that kind of edgy, slight cruelty that makes her really ideal to speak this kind of dialogue, because there's something, and I think this is true of Transparent as well, although unlike Steve, I haven't followed the whole thing, is that there's a ruthlessness to her sense of humor, to Soloway's sense of humor, and she seems to mesh well with Catherine Hahn in that way. Hahn is not an actress who's trying to be loved and adorable and get the audience's attention and affection at every second.
There's not a lot of bunny-like nose scrunching by Catherine Hahn. She's totally tough and fearless and unselfconscious, even as she's like insecure and frustrated. She's insecure and frustrated, but she doesn't seem to be cowed in her self-expression at all. And that does feel fresh. And Catherine Hahn is great.
Well, and there's also the implication, which is why I would keep watching the show if it were picked up, at least for a while, to see where it goes. But there seems to be the implication that her character, Chris Krause, who's also the author of the novel that it's based on, or sort of metafictional novel, I guess, that she's going to become more ruthless and more kind of growing into her own, you know, taking up space kind of personality as the show goes on, since the plot of the first episode seems to sort of be her reinventing herself as an artist.
Yeah, I mean, I'm dying to know what happens and want to continue watching, absolutely. I think, I mean, academia maybe isn't exactly where this is set, but the husband appears to be some kind of an intellectual slash academic and speaks like one. And frankly, so is the Kevin Bacon character. So let's call it academia. Academia is too easy to satirize, which is why academia is so hard to satirize in a way. And I think critical to satirizing it is making people believe that it's both self-serious to a preposterous degree, especially relevant to this actual stakes, and yet not totally silly, so that you don't know why anyone is bothering to train a satirical canon on it. And that's a target I would continue watching, in part just for the drama of it. I love the sexiness of Kevin Bacon's performance so far. That's absolutely the linchpin of the show, in a way, is you have to believe that there's a cultish cultish sexiness to this intellectual that the husband may have desperately wanted when he was younger, but absolutely doesn't have in middle age, late middle age. However, I do think you need to believe that the pretentious things they're saying aren't totally silly, especially when you learn what the nature of the novel was, which I admit also to not having read. But apparently the novel is itself presented in a postmodern, highly self-conscious style, and it's about people who read and think about postmodern nonfiction and fiction and theory. You have to believe that they're onto something, or you just think they're a bunch of ninnies. And that was my biggest intrigue, but also anxiety about the show, that you know, the husband is a blowhard and a bit of an ass, and the Kevin Bacon figure is super compelling and sexy and kind of withholding in this powerful way. But I hope to come to believe that they're not just pretentious twits, you know, fucking each other in a boring round robin.
I mean, I do think that there's a couple directions it could go. I mean, certainly the description of the husband's research, where he wants to, like, crack open the Holocaust to find a new angle on it, definitely seems to be presented with ridicule in mind. But the notion, I hadn't quite thought about the notion that the game that the pilot plays, and the pilot is sort of cut through with these title cards written in the voice of letters from Catherine Hahn's Chris to Kevin Bacon's Dick, all about how attractive she finds him and how she likes him and how her life is going. For the pilot, she does write this notional letter to Dick, and you don't quite know whether she sent it or not, and she describes a set of things that didn't happen. So there's sort of this mix of the fantasy flashback, which we see on screen, and what we saw to have really happened. And I wonder if that's where the show is going in this kind of blend between the reality in the letters and the reality out of the letters, and whether the twain ever meet. That would be more interesting to me than just who fucked who and Marfa.
What did you guys think of those title cards that Julia was talking about? There's these moments where the story goes to a red screen with white capital letter words on it, and they're either repeating a line of dialogue that was just said or making some sort of categorical statement or sometimes naming the next section of the show. I found them distracting. I think they're maybe an attempt to replicate the metafictional shape of the novel in some way, but they reminded me of Jenny Holzer, you know, that artist who has video, like, I don't know, platitudes that flash up that always seem sort of so proud of themselves because their words flashing up on a screen, but that what they're usually saying is completely uninteresting.
I never thought about the smug pride of the Jenny Holzer scroll.
Jenny Holzer is so smug.
Look at me. I put words in a museum. I thought the title cards were cutesy. I didn't love it. I mean, I think this is maybe an instance where the pilot doesn't quite bear out the whole notion of the show, right? Like, if the whole show is going to turn out to be about text and reality and letters and blah, 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 maybe that will come to feel like an urgent, necessary part of whatever puzzle it's going to untangle. But if they're just like a stylish way to say that Kevin Bacon is hot and Catherine Hahn wants to fuck him, that seems like less worthwhile to have been so cute.
Well, the novel, if I'm not mistaken, dates from 1997, I believe, which is right around the tail end of the heyday of theory in humanities departments. And there's still something like a viable cult of personality around, among some of the sort of superstar theory heads. And that moment is past, right? So there's very little residual glamour to it. The intertitles will work and the show will work if we can believe there's some substance to the set of postmodern cliches that really animated that moment in academia. And those cliches had to do with writing and texts and the relationship of people to the accumulated cultural symbols of the past, and postmodernism had to do with being entrapped within them, but maybe finding a way out by being playful with them. If all of that seems like the masturbatory in talk of a bunch of hyper intellectuals, then I think the show goes nowhere. If people can be led to find it sexy and vital and somewhat true, the way you feel when you watch, for example, Dangerous Liaisons, which is all about how people invoke one another and bring themselves into being through writing, especially erotically. I mean, that work has lasted a couple of centuries. So I don't know that it has to be inert or anachronistic. It could be quite interesting. But that's where I am on the intertitles and the show.
Well, we will see if they give Jill another shot.
All right. The show is I Love Dick. It's available streaming on Amazon, after which I think you're invited to vote on whether it should be allowed to continue to live. My vote would be yes. What about you guys?
Yeah, sure. Let 1,000 postmodern Marfa comedies bloom.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll stick around for another few episodes to see what happens.
For Catherine Hahn.
Yeah.
If nothing else. All right. Well, let us know at facebook.com/culturefest what you thought of the show. All right. Moving on. Jefferson Airplane was one of the truly defining rock and roll bands of the 60s. Their lead singer, Grace Slick, was a famous 60s bad girl. They had huge hits with White Rabbit and Somebody to Love. And then came, not exactly nothing, but they changed their name to Jefferson Starship. They soldiered through the 70s. Then in the 80s, they decided they wanted a nest egg. There's nothing wrong with it. But they cut a POS single called We Built This City, went into heavy rotation on MTV. It went to number one. And GQ has now put out a very amusing oral history of this song, the hook being that it's possibly the worst, or there's absolutely nothing hypothetical about it. They assert it's the worst song of all time. This is fun in itself, but it raises some very GabFest questions. What makes something historically bad? We're joined by Chris Malampley, Slate contributor. Hey, Chris.
Hey, how are you, Steve?
Very good. How are you doing?
I'm okay. I'm trying not to be too insulted that this is why you guys called me in, but otherwise, otherwise I'm great.
Worst song of all time. Get Malampley in here.
Pretty much. And it's a number one hit, too. So, you know, it's a twofer for me.
Perfect.
It is a twofer. I was going to say, usually we have you in here to ask why something is popular or a total success. Well, Christy, you give me a great segue right there. We can begin by discussing this song was a huge hit. And not only was it a huge hit, it gave them subsequently three other, I believe, number one hits in the 80s from a kind of puppet show plus Spinal Tap kind of joke into a into a big touring act. Talk a little bit about this, about the commercial fate of the song.
So, yeah, We Built This City was a number one hit in the fall of 1985 at the height of MTV's first era. MTV is you know, part of this backstory of this song, because, you know, if you haven't had the pleasure of watching the music video, you really owe it to yourself to dial into YouTube. We'll link to it from the show page and witness all of the many state-of-the-art 1985 effects of the video. But, you know, the song is the song. And as you pointed out in your intro, the band Starship has such a tangled history. You actually even elided their 70s history as Jefferson Starship, that basically, you know, the band was founded by Paul Kantner, who actually died just in the last year in the 60s. It was, you know, avatars of the hippie 60s with those hits you mentioned, White Rabbit and Somebody to Love. Then in the 70s, they actually became something of an arena rock act as Jefferson Starship, Paul Kantner was still in the band. Grace Slick was still in the band. Marty Balin, some of the original members. But this is the period in the 70s where one by one they're starting to replace members. And by the end of the 70s, as the second wave of hits like Miracles were drying up, they started bringing in other session people like a new lead singer named Mickey Thomas. And so by the 80s, they have morphed into kind of many steps removed from what they were, first as a hippie band, then as a, you know, arena rock act. And as noted in this GQ oral history of We Built This City, Grace Slick was pretty well, – first of all, Grace Slick was the last remaining member of the 60s incarnation of Jefferson Airplane at this point. Briefly, Paul Kantner, who founded the group, left the group angrily in 1984 and took the Jefferson part of the name with him. So the group could no longer call themselves either Jefferson Airplane or Jefferson Starship, so they just went with Starship. And so starting in 1985, that's when they became Starship. And this, We Built This City, was the group's first single under that moniker, and it was an enormous number one hit. I suppose we can talk about why this thing was such a fungus and why it did so well. So maybe now would be a good time to listen to this. For those of you who hate this song as much as the many people described in this article do, I apologize in advance. But this was the number one song in, I believe it was November of 1985, Starship's We Built This City.
We built this city.
Lincoln comes in right at the end of the first chorus.
And starts lip-syncing.
And starts lip-syncing in the music video. Yeah, you have to see that.
You guys, can I just question the premise of this whole segment?
Sure.
That song is fucking great.
Oh, my God.
And we were all sitting here with massive grins on our face. That is a really catchy chorus.
It is.
The lyrics are preposterous. I mean, yes. They are absurdly bad.
Too many runaways eating up the night, Julia.
That doesn't make sense. There's also the, like, sink in this fight. Like the words almost seem mad-libbed into incoherence.
Do you want to talk about why the lyrics sound that way? Anyway, sorry, finish your thought.
Let's get to it. But they're, like, delivered with gusto. It's like the sine qua non of like an absurd 80s song. There's also the underlying irony that they're claiming to have built a city on rock and roll when in fact they are exhibiting robustly the sound and kind of production that maybe like pitched a few early spoonfuls of dirt onto the grave of rock and roll of the kind that the band's legacy might have been connected to. But like the whole GQ oral history takes as its premise that this is the worst song ever because Blender said so in 2004. I was expecting like a bit of a critical intro up top, sort of like Blender named it in 2004, but here's why this is the worst song ever, and thus we should have an oral history about it. And then they just didn't. They just left it. And we're like, yeah, Blender, defunct music magazine Blender, once claimed on a lark that this was the worst song ever. And just to finish the thought, and then I promise I'll let someone else talk, but it's clearly a ludicrous song, but it's very enjoyably ludicrous.
Oh.
It is so catchy. And like the actual worst song ever would be like some dumb song that you never heard.
No, Julia, you completely misunderstand the framework here. For something to be the worst song of all time, it has to be a good song. As a premise, it has to be catchy, so catchy that it freaking earworms you to the grave. It has to have been a big hit. It has to have been importantly bad, right? It has to capture a moment or an attitude revoltingly, which takes a certain kind of zeitgeist genius as much as capturing a moment admirably does. All of these things make something meaningful enough to be called worst. There are plenty of in some kind of small B bad sense, worse songs than this one. But this is, Chris, back me up here. There is something uniquely bad about this song.
This is a terrible song. I mean, there's no question this is a terrible song.
But can you guys agree? I do agree strongly with one thing Julia said, which is that just setting that out as this unquestioned critical shibboleth and going from there seems completely uninteresting as a method of talking about bad songs.
Well, and I will agree with Julia to the extent that, I tend to think that the worst songs are sort of, flaccid, backgroundy ballads or, things that just kind of lie there. This record does not lie there. I mean, this record wants to be your friend from the moment it opens up. It is aggressive. It is like,
it's humping your leg.
Thank you. Yes, that's actually brilliantly put. It is humping your leg.
It's a leg humper. It's a total leg humper.
It is totally humping your leg. In fact, when we started the song, Dana asked me, oh, wow, does it actually start with the chorus like that? Yes, it actually starts with the chorus like that.
And not even like, it's not even a chorus with a build. Like the beginning of the chorus is the hook.
Right.
Like, it just starts with a hook, like immediately.
One of the most revealing lines in this GQ oral history is Grace Slick. It's actually not out of the mouth of Grace Slick. It's from one of the producers who said he'd been instructed by Grace Slick, I want hits. She saw this as like her final lap with this band that she'd been, hanging out with and flogging since the 60s. And she's like, look, whatever you have to do, I just want hits. And this is, kind of like the producer saying, OK, you said you wanted a hit. Here you go. I mean, it's sort of aggressively catchy. And it's like the Ned Flanders of records. It wants to be friends with you the instant it meets you. And this is the record that, they served up to her. You also actually, Julia, mentioned the strange lyric. One of the most interesting things about this is who wrote it. It started as a record by Bernie Taupin of Elton John fame. So Bernie Taupin is a really interesting songwriter because he's mostly a lyricist. If you've ever listened to a vintage Elton John song like Your Song and thought to yourself, why is it that these words sound like they were written on a page before somebody actually tried to put music to them? That's because that's actually the way Bernie Taupin writes. He writes lyrics, hands them to Elton John, and then Elton John puts music around them. By the 80s, Elton John was diversifying and doing some of his own songwriting, and Bernie Taupin was also trying to diversify. And so he teamed up with like a different set of producers, including this guy Martin Page, who'd been in a minor synth pop group called Q Feel, and they put together the record. And what's so hilarious is that the it's kind of like two records grafted together. The Bernie Taupin Martin Page version was this dystopian post Blade Runner thing about Blade Runner crossed with Footloose. It's like a town where people can't dance anymore, and the radio stations have all been taken over by corporations. Probably the most interesting verse is the one Grace Slick sings solo, where she talks about people always playing corporation games, whatever that means. And then it was handed to Starship's producers, including a guy named Peter Wolf, not to be confused with the Peter Wolf of the Jay Giles Band, but Peter Wolf, an Austrian producer, pop schlockmeister, who said, this thing needs a chorus. And they came up with the chorus that has the Marconi plays the mamba part. Interesting aside, a mamba is a snake. It is not a form of music. If they meant mambo, they should have said mambo. But instead, they clearly say mamba. And they even talk about that in the GQ profile.
If Marconi had played the mamba, we never would have had radio in the first place.
Exactly. They're killing Marconi. Marconi, the inventor of radio. Anyway, so yeah, it's
this podcast would exist.
Exactly. So it's this Frankenstein's monster of a thing that Bernie Taupin wanted to be, this dystopian thing grafted onto this big power chorus that, like I said, is humping your leg, to use Steve's phrase.
Mm. I mean, also, let's bring ourselves back to 1985. The question on a lot of people's minds was, how would the generation that invented the concept of selling out, how would they deal with adulthood, right? It was one of the dominating questions of the 80s. And to have, Grace Slick, Chris, was as associated with the counterculture as really any rock and roll musician could be.
Definitely.
And basically to have her come out and say, I am going for the money without shame, was as defining of this song as anything.
I would agree. I mean, what's also interesting about Grace Slick, who gives very few interviews and has been largely off the grid for the last 20 years, is, they're using quotes from other interviews because they couldn't get her to talk for this profile, unsurprisingly. Grace Slick's own opinion about this song is something of a matter of debate, because she was saying nice things about it in 1985. And one of the things that's fascinating, frankly, about the whole oral history is that even some of the members of the group who are more, positive about the song, like Mickey Thomas, the lead singer, or Craig Chiquico, the guitarist, is they almost feel like 20 years, 30 years of being told this is a terrible song has trained them to say, all right, you know, I guess if people think it's a terrible song, it's a terrible song. But I think it gets at the debate that you and Julia are having right now. Is this an awesomely bad song? Is it just an awesome song? Is it just terrible and irredeemable? Like, I don't think the members of the band can even make up their minds about whether they should be embarrassed about this song.
Not to not to be off topic here, but just as the, like, magazine editor in the group, I did not think that was a very good oral history. Like, I did not think it was very well edited, or that the, I mean, the conceit of it is funny. It is like the only good autoplay music joke ever, that, you know, it's like anathema on the web to autoplay music. But when you pull up the story and start to read it, the song just plays out of your browser. Like, props to GQ for that. That's just like a great gag. Loved it. And the notion, you know, I think the oral history thing is overplayed, but to go deep on this particular song, I like that. But the setup of why it's so bad or what a bad song is, just like skipping that step. I was annoyed at them for missing that little bit of intellectual work, A, because it seemed lazy, and B, because I think it would have provided a better grounding for the set of conversation that follows. And then sure. I just think the way that the band is talking to and around each other, it seems almost like, again, it was played more for laughs than for inquiry into the song or the question of what a bad song is. Like, the piece seems like a big scoff and not actually curious about bad music to me, and I like was not into the oral history because I felt like fundamentally it was like poking its buddy in the rib and laugh and pointing and laughing rather than trying to figure something out.
Chris, do you dignify the concept? Do you think it's meaningful? And if so, can you give us a couple of examples of what might be the worst song of all time?
About worst songs? Well, okay.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not sure I'm gonna, you know, solve this riddle of is a bad song a big fat hit that is actually very catchy, or is a bad song just a song that lays there and, you know, is not at all interesting? This is an eternal debate. In fact, I go every spring to Seattle to the pop conference at the Experience Music Project, which is like a gathering of pop critics. And in 2015, so not this year but last year, they actually convened a panel about this very topic, worst songs. And there was something of a debate about this. I'm not sure we solved anything there either, but they polled everybody about terrible songs and you know, asked them, you know, what would you nominate as one of the worst songs of all time? And folks were kind of all over the map. Some of the ones that people landed on included What's Up by Four Non Blondes, which I definitely stump hard for. I can't stand that song. Who Let the Dogs Out is a perennial favorite. We Are the World is one that people have debated.
Is What's Up the one that's the What's Going On?
Yes, that's the one from the mid-90s.
Got it.
And by the way, melodically, it's identical to Don't Worry, Be Happy by Bobby McFerrin. I'm surprised Bobby McFerrin never sued them, but that's an aside. I actually proposed a song that was a very minor hit. It like reached number 61, I think, on the Hot 100 by a contemporary Christian group called Power Source. And the song was from the 80s and it was called Dear Mr. Jesus. It's a song decrying child abuse sung by a little girl features a children's choir at the chorus. And this thing actually got played on Z100 in New York in the mid 80s. I remember it vividly. And it's just teeth-rattlingly awful. Usually when I get into debates over worst song, you know, discussions, I say, okay, but is it worse than Dear Mr. Jesus? Dear Mr. Jesus to me is like the barometer of like an abysmal song. The fact that it was a minor hit barely qualifies it for this discussion. But you had a point, Steve, when you talked earlier about the ones that really drive you crazy are the number one hits, the big ones that are omnipresent and surrounding you at all times, like We Are the World or We Didn't Start the Fire by Billy Joel, a song that I know Julia has a long history with herself based on a previous segment we did. Or even Hotel California by the Eagles. That was another one proposed in our
that
segment.
That was going to be my – in fact, I asked our producer to pull a clip of Hotel California because that's one of my all-time worst songs.
All right. I want to hear your case for that though, Dana. Why is that the worst song of all?
Well, I mean, I guess this is occurring to me as Chris was talking just now, is that it seems like a lot of these songs that we're talking about, what they have in common is bombast and self-seriousness, right? That's one thing that easily makes a pop song unlikable, even if it's catchy, right? I mean,
obviously, if you're going to be a purist about it, the worst song is a song you can't even remember after you hear it because it has no hook. But that doesn't make for an interesting conversation. We want, as Steve said, to talk about like big songs that everyone knows, that everyone gets stuck in their head, but that have something loathsome about them. I think to me, Hotel California just passed its date. Its sell by date is so long gone. It's been so overplayed for so many decades. There was probably a period where I could stand to hear it, but now that's a run for the radio to turn it off song. Mm-hmm. And in general, the ones for me that fall into that category are things like Hotel California that are kind of long, wordy ballads that are very self-serious and pompous and that, unfurl some kind of story, especially if it has any sort of occult or mystical. It's just so boring, that song. When it starts, you just look down the long horizon until it's going to be over.
Yeah, Stairway to Heaven certainly is there. It's funny, Hotel California came on the radio not 3 days ago when I was driving my family somewhere. And my wife and I decided to see if we could remember all the lyrics. And you realize this thing is written with the idea that one day it'll be in the Norton Anthology of Poetry, right? Like the person really thinks that they're... And that just opens a new horizon, special horizon of badness.
Such a nice surprise. Bring your alibis. I have this very clear memory of singing Hotel California in France in some kind of like bar after hours. This probably actually was in the 80s at some point. Anyway, somebody bringing guitar, and that was one of the few songs they knew, and me thinking, like, I hate this song, but I know every word. And because I was the American in the bar, I wound up kind of giving the lyrics to everyone. And just
and you're probably shaking your head the whole time, like, you can check out anytime you like, but you can never leave.
I still remember speaking that line, getting to that, you can check out anytime you like, but you can never leave.
Her mind is Tiffany Twisted. I have to say that I think the crown of scorn is worn unequivocally by Wonderful Tonight by Eric Clapton.
Oh, that's a pretty good one.
It manages to be mawkish, patronizing.
Yep.
Sexist.
Sexist, idiotic, hooky, overplayed, self-important, lachrymose, and thoroughly disgusting to the core all at the same time.
It's true. The idea of a couple who Wonderful Tonight is their song, like you just hate both of those people right off the bat.
There are thousands of people who think that's their song, you know.
Of course. I hope one day to come back as a wedding singer and to do it justice. But Julia, your silence tells me there's a seething quality to it. You don't believe anything about this segment or this category.
No. I'm searching within my soul because, so first of all, I like both of your suggestions more than We Built the City. Like, I would much, if I was forced to live on an island and only hear one song for the rest of time, and I had to choose between Wonderful Tonight, Hotel California, and We Built the City, I would definitely choose We Built the City. At least I could like bop around while I was trying to like shake the coconuts down from the coconut tree as opposed to just like maundering sadly, right?
I'd like to change my vote, and We Built the City is now my least favorite song of all time.
So actually my silence was not seething, but me looking through all of the number one hits of the 90s to try and remember a song from my youth that I found to be completely inert and dumb. Definitely All for Love, Bryan Adams and Rod Stewart and Sting.
That one's the nadir for me too.
That's like,
on that.
I never need
it's to. Worse than Everything I Do It For You. That's a worse song, for Love.
Yeah, I never ever need to hear that song again. Another hit song that I never need to hear again, Smooth by Santana featuring Rob Thomas.
That one frequently makes polls of worst songs. Yeah,
I like that song. Oh my God, we could talk about this for the next 36 hours straight, or I could at least, but I think we have to wrap it here. Anyway, the GQ piece is called An Oral History of We Built This City, the Worst Song of All Time. We were joined blissfully by Chris Malamphy. This was, it's always fun. Chris, this may have been the funnest. Thanks so much for coming on.
You're most welcome, Steve. I'm no longer insulted.
See you soon. Well, it's been a summer of high-profile turkeys, culminating in Ben-Hur, which cost, I guess, a gazillion dollars, only took in about 10 or so million. A much bigger bellwether for all of this is our own show. We really didn't talk about blockbusters this summer, and no one among us or our audience seemed to miss it. All of this has led the New York Times to speculate, for the first time since moviegoing became a staple of American life, an underappreciated revenue engine. Ticket buyers who still trek to theaters more for the experience than for the movie itself may finally be conking out. Dana, this to me was the nugget in this piece that the Times ran, which is that essentially for the entire history of movies being shown in theaters, people just showing up at the theater and literally asking, they've surveyed this, literally asking what's good or what's playing next is a significant portion of the audience, maybe as much of a quarter. And in the age of home viewing and, frankly, lower quality movies, this is shrinking, and that's not insignificant for Hollywood. I know, Dana, you deal with these kind of big think millennial questions about the death of movies all the time, to the point where these articles hardly make you blink. But what do you think about this argument? Is something really changing? Was this a uniquely bad summer? Why was it bad? Is it just a blip? Your turn.
Yeah, well, the reason that I tend to roll my eyes at these movies are dead pieces, even though they may make a lot of good points about, you know, where the entertainment industry is going, is that, well, this, taking this one, for example, this Brooks Barnes piece in The Times, there's a lot of numbers voodoo going on, almost the way politicians will take whatever numbers they want and make them mean whatever they want. So this, you know, big death of movies, hand-wringing piece contains the following statistics, that many of which contradict each other. Attendance has declined this summer. It's expected to decline by 3.5%. It's not quite clear to me whether that's the year to date or just the summer, but there's this decline that has been marked. But for the same year, theaters have generated $8.11 billion in ticket revenue, which is a 5% increase from last year, I think. It's not clear. And attendance in movies is also up about 1.2%. Those are all such small percentages, for one thing, that I would imagine that from year to year, there's frequently a fluctuation that small. But also, two out of the three of those statistics show that movies are doing better than they were last year. So this is not me saying the movies can never die. I mean, I think there are legitimate questions to be asked about what's happening with the internet and the expansion of entertainment options. But to cast a pall over movies because there's been a bad summer at the box office seems like a strange critical move that for some reason everyone loves to fall in line with. And I don't know, all I know is that as a follower of film Twitter, I couldn't find a single serious critic or industry analyst I agree with who seemed to have this dark outlook for the future of movies.
Julia, do you agree with that? I mean, it does seem to me some argument can be made that viewing habits are changing. I would say over the course of us doing the show, the kind of water cooler effect of big Hollywood blockbuster releases has really declined during the same period of long form TV and kind of, you know, quality television has skyrocketed. None of this adds up to a secular trend. What do you think?
Is a secular trend a trend without facts attached to it? What's a secular trend?
A secular trend is just one playing out over a long sort of almost semi-generational.
Oh, as in century secular, not religious secular.
It's used on Wall Street, mate.
Okay. Your Wall Street analyst self is Australian? Okay. Continuing on. So first of all, I'm glad you called out the way in which Brooks Barnes deploys facts in that piece, Dana, because it is very slippery and very strange. I mean, this notion, even the notion that Steve cited in his intro, that the number of people who show up to the movies and are like, I'm going to see a movie in theaters tonight. And then they get to the theater and they're like, what movie this time? Maybe declining. He shows 2 years during which there was a decline and then they stopped measuring it this year. So even that statistic is like a little slippery. So that's not super persuasive. And then the part of the piece that you cited, Dana, I think the thing about the rise is it's like a 1.5 increase in overall viewership this year against a 3.5% decline in viewership this summer, which is just like so not conclusive. And the other piece that Barnes links out to is a piece by Brian Raftery that appeared in Wired a couple weeks ago, I think, making essentially the same argument from a less like beat reporter in the newspaper way and more of a cultural critic way. And that one is just as incoherent and crazy. It at once argues like nobody's talking about movies anymore. And then it says, actually, we did have a ton of conversations about movies this year, but they weren't about the movies themselves. They were around the movies, like Oscar's So White. And, you know, what do we think of Nate Parker's past rape charge, given his upcoming movie, Birth of a Nation? And, you know, he cited a few more kind of meta conversations around movies, which like, OK, so we still seem to care about what's happening in the movies just because the conversations happen to be a little meta over the summer when the boring stuff gets put out, whatever. And of course, we were there even just a few years ago. We were talking intensely about movies, and it seemed like you really had to see movies like Gravity and Creed and Mad Max Fury Road. And it's like, that was last year.
Right, Star Wars.
That was
the end of last year.
That
everybody was
like
talking about
6 months ago. Chill the fuck out, people. So both of these pieces are full of individual data points and details where you are like, dudes, get your shit together. These arguments are full of holes. On the other hand, to Steve's secular trend point, it feels right. Like there's something that does feel somewhat right about some of this, where it just seems like the alpha role that movies have played in culture is shifting a bit. Like it used to be that the biggest thing you could be was a movie star. And now it's like the biggest celebrities that we talk about and think about right now and who are like connecting on social media and being clever about their self-presentation are like
you know, Beyonce, Rihanna, Kanye, like all these musicians and their complicated, like, logistics of the ways in which they
present
their music.
Or TV creators like Amy Schumer or Lena Dunham, yeah. Right?
Right. Yeah, and then there's sort of the comedian, there's the musician self-presentation boom, which is like very forged through social media. Then there's the comedian creator boom where we sort of, you know, the same thing that happened with baseball teams, like where you want to know about the person behind the players thing has happened, but more in TV than in movies because I don't know why, because the kind of writer showrunner model lends itself more to the kind of social chit chat that makes you famous right now. And then television generally, like just the energy that's going into television and turning it into something that people watch is happening. And then people watching things from home means that you sort of can say, oh, I'll catch that movie later. I'll catch that movie on demand in a way that augurs against going to the theater. And not to sound like a broken record, but the thing that we've constantly decried of studios really trying to pre-sell everything and sell it for an international audience and make everything a sequel or a bit of existing intellectual property just means everything's worse. So I there's this gut level on which it's interesting to note this fact pattern and imagine forward 10 years, a world where like being a movie star is like, I don't know, being a like successful toy manufacturer or something.
Starbucks.
I don't know. Just being like an infomercial person. Like, I don't know what level of fame, probably neither of those, but where it just isn't the alpha celebrity thing to be.
I guess, but I mean, I think I have to push back a little bit on just the
factlessness.
Oh, of your initial point,
no,
Julia?
I'm lumping me in with you. You and I are both here on Team
Anti-Fact.
No,
more like the ahistoricity of it. I mean, I was just recently listening to one of Karina Longworth's podcasts about a year, I believe it was 1948, but it might have been 1938, when there was a meeting of all the major studio heads in Hollywood trying to figure out how are we going to get people back into the movie theaters. It must have been 1948 because it was the beginning of TV, possibly.
48 wouldn't have been TV, though.
Yeah, I mean, I
listened to that episode. It was good.
Was it 38?
Don't remember, but it was very good. Whichever decade it was about. Great app.
I mean, at least since the emergence of television, there's been this dialogue about what's going to happen to movies. Why should people go out to the theater when they can stay home? What can we give them that will bring them into the theater? I think there's a very strong case to be made, even from these numbers that we're talking about and from general trends in the last 15 years, that gigantism of the kind that runs Hollywood now, of the kind that Mark Harris wrote about so intelligently and using numbers like in a more convincing way a couple years ago when he was talking about the way – we talked about this on the show, I believe – the way that big tentpole blockbusters hold up the movie industry. And it's because they do really well overseas and because you have a couple giant Avengers-type movies that clean up that there's any money left lying around on the floor to make, you know, some mid-budget or smaller movies. And one of these pundits that we were reading making this huge point that movies are descending almost seemed to be unconsciously, in spite of himself, making the case that the end of the era of gigantism could be a great thing for movies. It could be the way that people start coming back into the theaters again, and that there's this almost corollary effect of smaller mid-budget movies or particularly low-budget movies that way outperform what they were expected to do, right? That's sort of allowed to flourish in the undergrowth of this big decaying superstructure. But wouldn't that be a great thing for the movies? I mean, should we maybe not be celebrating that summer blockbusters are no longer going to be expected to hold us all up?
I completely agree with you. We should point out Don't Breathe is the number one movie at the box office, a small budget horror film. You know, Dana, there was a moment in the late 60s when the reckoning did happen, and Hollywood, because of the success of Sound of Music, copycatted themselves nearly to death, making huge budget musicals. People really were staying home and watching TV. They weren't going to the movies. Furthermore, Hollywood, interestingly enough, that magnificent superstructure does have a way of ignoring it's very internal to itself and very self-important, and it has a way of missing what it shouldn't be missing. And in the late 60s, it had missed two things completely. It had still not understood the revolution that was happening in European cinema with Truffaut and the Nouvelle Vague and the auteur. It didn't understand how that had caught fire in Europe throughout the 60s. And the second thing it had completely missed was the energies of the counterculture. And that's why the story, which Mark Harris has told as beautifully as anyone, the backstory of Bonnie and Clyde is so fascinating. I mean, how Hollywood resisted these changes, and Jack Warner buried Bonnie and Clyde. He scarcely wanted to make it. And that was a huge turning point in the fortunes of Hollywood. And they revived because there were suddenly, with Bonnie and Clyde, there were suddenly things that you had to go to the movie theater to see, things that you would not see on television, principally sex and violence, but though in the context, and then thanks to Bonnie and Clyde and Easy Rider, the counterculture suddenly on movie screens unendingly, and then thanks to obviously The Godfather, Taxi Driver, and Annie Hall, the American auteur was at the forefront for the better part of a decade. But it shows you that there is something magnificently unsupple about the Hollywood superstructure in a way, for as sensitive as you would think it would be to audience needs and desires. What it doesn't pick up on is fascinating. But I think we're at that kind of a turning point, but it's going to take more than courage, because let's be absolutely honest, I'm confident in saying there isn't a single studio executive whose career has been built on courage. So it's not going to be courage. It's going to take a trend shift to move people away from Ben-Hur and towards Don't Breathe. But it could be that we're at that moment, and that will be fascinating to watch.
I don't think you need much to turn people away from Ben-Hur. I think about four people went to see that movie.
Yeah, it would take courage to bend toward Ben-Hur at this point.
I understand, but you understand what I mean.
Yeah, yeah.
Totally pre-sold sequel, like built-in, you know, what they believe to be built-in popularity, which turns out to be no popularity at all.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing, the fact pattern, the factless fact pattern that feels right, despite the fact that it went unsuccessfully asserted within the two articles we're talking about today, does seem like it suggests a potential reinvention of cinema in a way that is pleasing to people who like to watch and talk about movies. What I think is likely, though, is that that reinvention might also mean that movies has a smaller place in the culture, that you could have a vivid and urgent moviescape that also still left us with a world where when you say the word star, you don't automatically think of the Oscars and fancy ladies and people who move around on a big screen in a dark theater.
Yeah, I think there's certainly an argument to be made for that. I mean, if you just think of what movies were when they began, you know, by what huge degree of magnitude they exceeded any other sort of entertainment sensory onslaught experience you could have, right? And now we can find all these other ways to surround ourselves. I mean, pretty soon we'll have whatever Google glasses on and be watching everything that's going on around and behind us. And that fact of going to pay money and sit in a room and look at a two-dimensional rectangle, just it doesn't pack the kind of aesthetic punch that it did in 1911.
Right.
Know?
I mean, it's kind of been a long ride, actually.
Yeah, they had a good run.
Okay, well, anyway, the piece is called Hollywood's Summer of Extremes, Mega Hits, Super Flaps, and Little Else by Brooks Barnes. It's on the New York Times website. You can find it there. This is one of those ones I really would love to hear from our audience, facebook.com/culturefest. What do you think about the experience of seeing movies? And how will you feel if it goes away or changes beyond recognition? All right, well, now is the moment in our podcast where we endorse. This week, we're going to do something slightly different. This is, alas, the last week that we will have Anne Hepperman as our producer. So Anne has joined us in the studio. She will endorse too. Anne, thank you for coming in.
Hey, thanks.
All right, Dana, let's start with you. What do you got?
The first is inspired by our worst song in history segment. I realized as I was researching the band that was Starship, that had previously been Jefferson Starship and before that Jefferson Airplane, that in their middle incarnation, the one that, as Chris mentioned, never had a number one hit, there's a song that I love and that I have a very strong memory from my childhood. It was a song from 1975. It's called Miracles. It made it to number three and stayed at number three for a few weeks. And I have this very clear memory of hearing that song on a camping trip with my family in Bastrop State Park in Texas, which sadly has since burned. I think nearly the entire park has gone down in wildfires. But we were camping among the pines, and my brother had his little transistor radio listening to Casey Kasem's Top 40. And I just have this wonderful memory of sitting on this hillside with him listening to Miracles on the transistor radio. And when I mentioned this to him many years later and said, do you remember that song Miracles by Jefferson Starship? He remembered the exact same moment of sitting in the pine needles listening to that song. Very, very dreamy, kind of spacey, sort of hippie-ish song that recalls, although it's not as great of a song, the 10cc hit I'm Not in Love, you know, with that sort of echoey, yeah, sure, repetitive, swirling sound. And it's a song that's always stuck with me. So Miracles is my first endorsement by Jefferson Starship. And my second is inspired by the presence of Anne Hepperman here in our endorsement segment, because she has a podcast that we're going to talk about further in our Slate Plus segment that how would you describe it? And it's a sort of a fictional, it's a storytelling podcast, yeah, in which you play a role. So it was funny, yeah, for me to hear your voice in the voice of a character. But the character is you, and it's kind of the saga of you falling in love, but with all sorts of sonic bizarreness going on all around you.
Yeah, it's called Serendipity, and it's a fiction podcast, but we blur the line between like host and story and the stories blending into each other. And even though I'm married, I get to have a fake Swedish boyfriend. So it's exciting.
I mean, I would describe it as layered. It's very audio layered in a way that makes you have to work to figure out exactly what's going on. It also seems to have running jokes, so that I think if I had listened to it straight through, as opposed to the few samples that I've listened to, that you would probably hear some of the same voices and same sounds emerging again and again. And that, I mean, basically, it's I would describe it as this kind of complex weave of sounds that the listener has to work to extract the story from. And that is unusual and, to me, is really interesting to hear.
Yeah. I mean, really what we're trying to do is we're trying to showcase radio drama for the 21st century and, like, challenge that idea of what does it mean to make radio drama for the 21st century. That's my goal. And then for me as the host, I just didn't want to be like, hey, I'm Anne and here's Martin and we're going to tell you what the best radio drama for the 21st century is. So it was kind of our storyline was created a bit out of wanting to have some fun. So I got a fake Swedish boyfriend out of it. You jealous, Steve?
Deeply, yeah.
Yeah, it's great. So
Serendipity on iTunes or anywhere you can find podcasts.
Yep, exactly.
Fantastic. All right, Julia Turner.
I have like more of a self-congratulation than a endorsement, but it's a collective one, so hopefully you guys will allow it. I think we had such a great summer strut this summer. I made like a Julia Turner cut of our final list and reduced it down to the songs I found most delectable. And I've been listening to it nonstop since we had that episode. I'm like so in love with almost all those songs. And one song that I wanted to endorse this week is one that Chris actually introduced during our segment as having just gotten to the number one spot. And we heard a very quick clip of it, but I wasn't really familiar with it yet because it hadn't been part of our big crop. And it's the song Cheap Thrills by Sia. And it is just a very great, catchy song.
Julia, can we put the Julia Turner reduction of the summer strut on Spotify and let listeners hear it? I want to hear it.
I guess so, but then you'll realize which of your songs I didn't like. But I guess I'm honest with you guys. We can.
Yeah, you already told me you didn't like my songs in person. So.
Yeah, I did nix all of the side pony people. Mm. All of your neo-soul. But a lot of the other stuff stayed in.
Excellent. All right. Well, very special moment indeed, Anna Hepperman. This is your farewell to us. It's been an amazing experience having you as our producer. But what do you have?
Well, I've got 10 endorsements. Just kidding. I was going to try it out to you, Steve. No, I have two. One I shared with Julia maybe about a month ago. It's an Instagram feed for anybody who's into birding. It's Office Buddha is the handle. Is that what you call an Instagram?
I think it's your handle.
It's your handle? Okay.
Sure.
Is that what the kids are calling it? The handle...
The kids aren't on Instagram.
Okay.
They're on Snapchat.
They're on Snapchat.
Breaker19. Right.
It's Office Buddha, and it's actually a friend of my sister's who lives in Chicago and had a family of peregrine falcons take over his balcony.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And so what he did, and they had babies. He named them, they're Steve and Linda Perry, and they had Tyler, Fred, and the Commodore, who he documented their hatching all on the Instagram feed. And it's really incredible. They've since flown away from the nest, but I'm assuming they'll probably be back in the springtime. Julia, would that
I don't
correct.
Know. My bird knowledge does not extend that far.
To peregrine falcon nesting behaviors?
Yeah. So you can watch. I mean, it's incredible. You see Steve and Linda bringing mice back to the new chicks. You see them. You just see the whole course of just peregrine falcon life on this Instagram feed.
Urban peregrine life.
Yeah, they're just birds. They're just a family trying to get by.
No wonder the movies are dead. I mean, all I want to do now is watch birds on Instagram.
Birds of prey are just the best. They're the best. They're so fascinating to watch. And I have to say, Steve, I forget if you said this on mic or off when we were recording up at your place in Ghent, but you told me that there are many bald eagles on the Hudson River. And on our train ride back to New York City from Hudson, I saw like four bald eagles on the Hudson.
You pointed a couple out to me.
I was like yelling across the train car, and Dana and Anne were like, oh my God, we're with the irritating bird weirdo.
There was another excited couple, though, and you guys were just going, there's one.
Yeah, the nerds did gather.
Oh, my head was snapping around to see our national bird, but I only just caught a few little wings flapping.
Yeah, there were also lots of other herons and fun things. But anyway, thanks for the bird of prey tip, Steve. Yeah. That was a hot tip.
I have just one more. I'm a big fan of Grand Central Terminal, and so I like going there. I go there every week for work. It's part of my commute. But in Vanderbilt Hall, which is one of the halls off to the side, there's a particularly fascinating educational slideshow right outside the door that if nobody, like, just really looks at it, but it gives you the entire history of Grand Central Terminal from when it was built, how the history of the old Penn Station and when it came down, the fight for Grand Central, Jackie Kennedy Onassis's involvement in it. So I highly recommend that as you're just walking through Vanderbilt Hall and going through the door to the outside, take a step to the left and just check out the amazing educational slideshow.
Oh, that's such Grand a great Central endorsement. I want to run up there and see it right now.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah.
Grand Central has so many mysteries that it's always unveiling. Like, that's one that I've never, ever thought
about. I thought you were going to mention the brand new Scandinavian food court that's in Vanderbilt Hall, which is supposed to be delicious. But I will certainly, next time I go there, ignore the delicious, like, cinnamon bread rolls and go straight for the slideshow.
That's it. Sorry, Steve. I wish I had more.
No, that's good. That's plenty. All right. Well, Julia Turner, I have to ask you, do you think it's indecorous of me to endorse my own cover version of the Elvis Costello song Allison?
Only if you're game to perform it.
Well, my thought is that I'll get up there and I'll do it with Dana if we sell out this LA show. I mean, I don't have acres and acres of blueberries to offer.
Can I just
you
point out that I wasn't consulted in any way before this was just thrown at me?
Also,
no,
can
and
I
by, and by the way, we're doing it in the key of E.
And also the last time that you promised to sing a song.
I made no promises at all.
You totally welched.
I think I'm willing to do this leading a sing-along. How about that? That way, you know, I'll be drowned out. But anyway, we'll sell out the LA show. Someone will bring a guitar and Dana and I will get up there and off mic, we'll gamely lead a crowd of 700 people in a version of Allison. Anyway, that's not my endorsement. My endorsement is...
That's just a random threat.
Exactly.
Just to keep us in line.
So I think last week I endorsed rapturously the first Ferrante novel. I then picked up I, Claudius by Robert Graves. That is such a great book. I mean, people probably have no memory of any of this, but it was the first... I think probably the really first classic, super high quality miniseries was I, Claudius. The BBC did a version of I, Claudius with Derek Jacobi in the title role that was magnificent, and it was a huge hit in the 70s over here on public TV. People don't read the novel enough that it's based on, but Graves obviously was a great British poet and wrote one of the truly wonderful memoirs of all time called Goodbye to All That. But I, Claudius, I think is arguably his masterpiece. It's such a magnificently weird Nabokovian take on Roman history, that key moment in Roman history when Augustus has been deified and Livia, who of course offers the basis for, I mean, clearly David Chase was familiar with this because he calls the matriarch, the demented matriarch of the Sopranos, Livia, completely knowingly. I mean, Livia is this magnificent character in I, Claudius, who's pulling all the strings behind the scenes. Augustus is essentially her puppet. It's a literary tour de force of a completely different kind from Ferrante's. It's not in the faux naive style. You're not meant to believe, of course, that there's an actual person telling actual events, even though it's based on history. It's a very, very self-consciously literary performance of the highest order, and wonderfully fun and deliciously weird and violent. It's fantastic. I couldn't recommend it highly enough. Anyway, and thank you so much for everything, but also for coming on to endorse.
Oh, yeah. Wait, I had one more endorsement, which is my favorite podcast. It's called the Slate Culture Gap Fest.
Aww.
So the hosts are amazing. Everybody should check it out.
Aww. Superb.
All right. That's the sentimentalism I'm going to get because I'm German. So,
yeah, she already told us no hugs.
No,
do
hugging.
Not approach me with extended arms.
I feel like that captures nicely Anne's wonderful affect as producer, which is that she is like incredibly full of love and vigor and has helped make our show so much better than it would otherwise have been for the last few years. But she also knows how to get tough when it's time in the best possible way.
Yeah.
No hugs.
When Anne says wrap it up, you wrap that segment up, baby.
Then you know it's about to go off the rails.
Okay, let's wrap it up.
Speaking of which. Dana, thank you so much.
Thanks, Stephen.
Julia, thanks. This was fun.
So fun.
And no thanks have the magnitude of your contributions to this show, but thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.
She's like, get out of here, guys.
I went in for a hug and I got what I deserved.
Rebuffed. All right. All right. Credit, Steve.
Just one pickup. If you can just say literary tour de force.
3, 2, 1. Literary tour de force.
Great.
Literary tour de force. Literary tour de force.
Got it.
I love that. A little pickup. Anne, I think you have to leave that in.
Okay, I'll leave it in.
And I also, sounds like Steve's line is roboting. So maybe we'll let you do the credits on the way out for your last time.
All right, here we go. You'll find links to some of the things we talked about today at our show page, slate.com/culturefest. And you can email us at culturefest@slate.com or drop us a note at our Facebook page, facebook.com/culturefest. Our producer is, me, Anne Haberman. Our intern is Lizzie Fison. The executive producer of Slate Podcast is Steve Lichtai. And Andy Bowers is the chief content officer of the Panoply Network. The Culture Gap Fest is part of the Panoply Network. Check out our entire roster on iTunes.com/Panoply. And our Twitter feed is @SlateCultFest. For Stephen Metcalf, Julia Turner, and Dana Stevens, I'm Anne Haberman, and I won't see you next week, but they will.